Listening Comprehension Test. You will hear each recording twice. After each listening, you will have time to complete your answers. Task 1. You now have time to read the assignments. One.
I do think there's a north-south divide. Generally in London and other southern areas, people get paid more and have more travel connections due to government plans. You also have things that are sort of more noticeable when you move between the north and the south. Generally, if you're taking a train, say, from London to Scotland, you'll notice that when you're in London, everyone's quite quiet and calm and keeping to their space. But as you move further north, everyone sort of starts to ask, "How's your day? Are you doing all right?" and sort of chatting a lot more. So there is also much more of a cultural difference between the North and South that's very obvious when you travel around the UK.
Two.
Most opportunities for people leaving university are in London. Most graduate schemes, most entry-level jobs with a long career progression exist only in London. And I think London is often described as kind of like a black hole for industry, where thousands of young people travel there after university and kind of get lost in London. And I think the north-south divide kind of replicates that in a way. Like, there's an assumption that no matter where you live in the UK, the opportunities are in London. So that is where you go after education.
Three.
I do think that there is a north-south divide in the UK. I think the stereotypes of the south having more job opportunities is definitely true, because London especially is seen as one of the bigger economic hubs. And I just think that a lot of the opportunities are very unevenly divided across the regions, especially like with public transport, job opportunities, education. So I'd say that although there are a lot of good universities and Russell Groups up north, a lot of them are also centralised to the south. And especially London has a lot of universities in itself.
Four.
I think the culture is very different. So not even just in like a divide of an equality sense, but there's definitely a difference in how people live in the north and how people kind of are and interact a lot of the time. And I don't think that's just class-based. I think there's an element of that, but I think you'll typically find that people of the same class in the south behave differently. And also the like middle class and upper class northerners even behave differently to a lot of middle class and upper class southerners.
Five.
I think a north-south divide exists in the UK. I would say that for people from the north, things associated with regional inequality would be, you know, poor access to education, poor access to health and transport infrastructure as well. So, for example, if you're from the north, you're more likely to live in poverty. You're more likely to have a low income job. But equally, if you're from the south, there are also issues. So if you live in a city like London, rents are really expensive. So is the cost of living, which can make it really unaffordable for young people.
Now listen to the recording again. One.
I do think there's a north-south divide. Generally in London and other southern areas, people get paid more and have more travel connections due to government plans. You also have things that are sort of more noticeable when you move between the north and the south. Generally, if you're taking a train, say, from London to Scotland, you'll notice that when you're in London, everyone's quite quiet and calm and keeping to their space. But as you move further north, everyone sort of starts to ask, how's your day? Are you doing all right? And sort of chatting a lot more. So there is also much more of a cultural difference between the north and south that's very obvious when you travel around the UK.
Two.
Most opportunities for people leaving university are in London. Most graduate schemes, most entry-level jobs with a long career progression exist only in London. And I think London is often described as kind of like a black hole for industry, where thousands of young people travel there after university and kind of get lost in London. And I think the north-south divide kind of replicates that in a way. Like, there's an assumption that no matter where you live in the UK, the opportunities are in London. So that is where you go after education.
Three.
I do think that there is a north-south divide in the UK. I think the stereotypes of the south having more job opportunities is definitely true, because London especially is seen as one of the bigger economic hubs. And I just think that a lot of the opportunities are very unevenly divided across the regions, especially like with public transport, job opportunities, education. So I'd say that although there are a lot of good universities and Russell Groups up north, a lot of them are also centralized to the south. And especially London has a lot of universities in itself.
Four.
I think the culture is very different. So not even just in like a divide of an equality sense, but there's definitely a difference in how people live in the north and how people kind of are and interact a lot of the time. And I don't think that's just class-based. I think it is, there's an element of that, but I think you'll typically find that people of the same class in the south behave differently. And also the like middle class and upper class northerners even behave differently to a lot of middle class and upper class southerners.
Five.
I think a north-south divide exists in the UK. I would say that for people from the north, things associated with regional inequality would be, you know, poor access to education, poor access to health and transport infrastructure as well. So, for example, if you're from the north, you're more likely to live in poverty. You're more likely to have a low income job. But equally, if you're from the south, there are also issues. So if you live in a city like London, rents are really expensive. So is the cost of living, which can make it really unaffordable for young people.
Task 2. You now have time to read the assignments.
On today's episode, my colleague Victoria Heath talks to Effie Capsalis. She's the Senior Digital Program Officer at the Smithsonian.
What do you love most about working at the Smithsonian?
One of the things I really love about the Smithsonian is learning something new virtually every day that I'm there. And we have people that are willing to share information and what they're studying and make that, you know, available to me to do the digital strategy work that I do.
I've been to multiple Smithsonian museums over the years. I had no idea how many museums were actually a part of the Smithsonian kind of network until Smithsonian Open Access. What was the purpose or is the purpose of Smithsonian Open Access?
There were a few things at play. One of our strategic goals was to reach 1 billion people a year with our digital work. Smithsonian Open Access was really about allowing people to participate in the Smithsonian's mission of increase and diffusion of knowledge. Our founder, James Smithson, talked about crowdsourcing in a 17th or an 18th century way. It's only through the participation of many that we can possibly understand the world.
I love that connection to the founder, actually. You know, that seems to be something that was part of his mission from the very beginning, is having things as open and accessible as possible.
We're the nation's museum, so we even crowdsourced our collections. One of our secretaries sent letters to people around the U.S. to send specimen and to start to understand the biodiversity around the U.S. So they were, you know, trappers in remote areas of the U.S. or new territories of the U.S. There were literally thousands of letters that went back and forth to people to send things to us.
That's a great story as to how the Smithsonian, the collection became so big, but also I think it's really an important part of the sort of the fabric, at least in the United States, of kind of our culture. Like, everyone sort of knows the Smithsonian, and it's definitely something that when I was growing up, I always wanted to go there every time. We lived in Virginia and North Carolina, so that was like my favorite place to go. Could you talk about sort of the process and the thinking behind launching this initiative?
I think we'd been talking around the edges of open access for a number of years. In 2015, I had the opportunity, when I was part of a leadership program at the Smithsonian, to do a study on what the impact of open access had been. And so I looked at about a dozen organizations worldwide. Fast forward to 3.5 years later, I was brought centrally, as you know, I've traveled around the Smithsonian, but I was brought centrally to lead the American Women's History Initiative digital work. And one of the key questions there was around representation of women online. I couldn't fulfill our mission of making women's history more visual online, making it more known online without an open policy. But that paper really became the material that our leadership and our board could look at and say, okay, we're not the first. This is safe territory. We're going to try it. We think it's the right thing for us as who we are as an institution. And we had that big digital goal to reach 1 billion people a year. So it was kind of a no-brainer at that point.
Now listen to the recording again.
On today's episode, my colleague Victoria Heath talks to Effie Capsalis. She's the Senior Digital Program Officer at the Smithsonian.
What do you love most about working at the Smithsonian?
One of the things I really love about the Smithsonian is learning something new virtually every day that I'm there. And we have people that are willing to share information and what they're studying and make that, you know, available to me to do the digital strategy work that I do.
I've been to multiple Smithsonian museums over the years. I had no idea how many museums were actually a part of the Smithsonian kind of network until Smithsonian Open Access. What was the purpose or is the purpose of Smithsonian Open Access?
There were a few things at play. One of our strategic goals was to reach 1 billion people a year with our digital work. Smithsonian Open Access was really about allowing people to participate in the Smithsonian's mission of increase and diffusion of knowledge. Our founder, James Smithson, talked about crowdsourcing in a 17th or an 18th century way. It's only through the participation of many that we can possibly understand the world.
I love that connection to the founder, actually. You know, that seems to be something that was part of his mission from the very beginning, is having things as open and accessible as possible.
We're the nation's museum, so we even crowdsourced our collections. One of our secretaries sent letters to people around the U.S. to send specimens and to start to understand the biodiversity around the U.S. So they were, you know, trappers in remote areas of the U.S. or new territories of the U.S. There were literally thousands of letters that went back and forth to people to send things to us.
That's a great story as to how the Smithsonian, the collection became so big, but also I think it's really an important part of the sort of the fabric, at least in the United States, of kind of our culture. Like, everyone sort of knows the Smithsonian, and it's definitely something that when I was growing up, I always wanted to go there every time. We lived in Virginia and North Carolina, so that was like my favorite place to go. Could you talk about sort of the process and the thinking behind launching this initiative?
I think we'd been talking around the edges of open access for a number of years. In 2015, I had the opportunity, when I was part of a leadership program at the Smithsonian, to do a study on what the impact of open access had been. And so I looked at about a dozen organizations worldwide. Fast forward to 3.5 years later, I was brought centrally, as you know, I've traveled around the Smithsonian, but I was brought centrally to lead the American Women's History Initiative digital work. And one of the key questions there was around representation of women online. I couldn't fulfill our mission of making women's history more visual online, making it more known online without an open policy. But that paper really became the material that our leadership and our board could look at and say, okay, we're not the first. This is safe territory. We're going to try it. We think it's the right thing for us as who we are as an institution. And we had that big digital goal to reach 1 billion people a year. So it was kind of a no-brainer at that point.
Task 3. You now have time to read the assignments.
congratulations on your new book. It's really fantastic. In the book, you talk all about living in London and in New York. How on earth did you come about spending so much time in these two rather different contexts?
So I spent a fair amount of time in these global cities, but I was born and raised in Jamaica and spent a fair amount of time, much of my childhood, in the Caribbean, and then moved to New York City to complete secondary school, went to university in the US, and then came to the UK to pursue postgraduate, what are called postgraduate studies here, what we call graduate studies in the US. During my time in London, I came across what for me seemed like a perplexing paradox, where I, one day in a chance conversation with a Black Caribbean teacher with salt and pepper hair I call Miss Bell, she expressed to me in no uncertain terms her surprise that as a Black Caribbean person that I could study at the University of Cambridge. She was shocked by that. And I asked her about why that was the case. And, you know, she revealed the sort of persistent negative framing of Black Caribbeans in the UK context. And I remember being shell-shocked by that, because in the US, or at least in New York City, where I went to secondary school, the dominant framing of Caribbeans was quite different. Black Caribbeans in New York were perceived to be hardworking, high-achieving, stereotyped as having multiple jobs, you know, chasing the American dream. And then what was really peculiar in all of this was that in both national contexts, it was being argued that the dominant reason for their achievement, high achievement in the US, as it were, and underachievement in the UK was Caribbean culture. And I kept thinking, well, how could it be Caribbean culture when the same people with the same culture are framed differently across two national contexts? I remember just working with students. Now, this wasn't abstract to me. This wasn't a set of statistical data points. I'm thinking about students I had worked with, and their faces would run across my mind. And I was trying to understand better that student's experience. And what I came to learn was that there was a deeper, richer history here. And it's not just about London and New York City. It's also about the Caribbean, right? And that's one of the core arguments I make in the project, in the book, that you cannot possibly understand the experiences of Caribbean immigrants to either London or New York City if you don't understand their perceptions of the US and the UK from the Caribbean. What I argue essentially in this book is that the use of culture to explain Black students' success or failure in schools is not only tricky, it's a trap. And it's a trap because we overemphasize the importance of culture, right? And we undermine the importance of national policy contexts, the order of migration, a range of structural and institutional factors that alongside culture can shape what students experience in schools or what their success or failure might be in schools.
And so before we get into some of the differences in history, what's the population size of Black Caribbeans in New York City and in the U.S.?
So to your question, it's really important to pay attention to these figures. The waves of migration from the Caribbean to the U.S. are ongoing. Immigration policies to the U.K., however, from the Caribbean are much more restrictive. And so migration from the Caribbean has really slowed to a trickle, the sociologist Phil Kasanitz suggests, whereas, you know, it's ongoing in the U.S.
Now listen to the recording again.
Congratulations on your new book. It's really fantastic. In the book, you talk all about living in London and in New York. How on earth did you come about spending so much time in these two rather different contexts?
So I spent a fair amount of time in these global cities, but I was born and raised in Jamaica and spent a fair amount of time, much of my childhood, in the Caribbean, and then moved to New York City to complete secondary school, went to university in the US, and then came to the UK to pursue postgraduate, what are called postgraduate studies here, what we call graduate studies in the US. During my time in London, I came across what for me seemed like a perplexing paradox, where I, one day in a chance conversation with a Black Caribbean teacher with salt and pepper hair, I call Miss Bell, she expressed to me in no uncertain terms her surprise that as a Black Caribbean person that I could study at the University of Cambridge. She was shocked by that. And I asked her about why that was the case. And, you know, she revealed the sort of persistent negative framing of Black Caribbeans in the UK context. And I remember being shell-shocked by that, because in the US, or at least in New York City, where I went to secondary school, the dominant framing of Caribbeans was quite different. Black Caribbeans in New York were perceived to be hardworking, high achieving, stereotyped as having multiple jobs, you know, chasing the American dream. And then what was really peculiar in all of this was that in both national contexts, it was being argued that the dominant reason for their achievement, high achievement in the US, as it were, and underachievement in the UK was Caribbean culture. And I kept thinking, well, how could it be Caribbean culture when the same people with the same culture are framed differently across two national contexts? I remember just working with students. Now, this wasn't abstract to me. This wasn't a set of statistical data points. I'm thinking about students I had worked with, and their faces would run across my mind. And I was trying to understand better that student's experience. And what I came to learn was that there was a deeper, richer history here. And it's not just about London and New York City. It's also about the Caribbean, right? And that's one of the core arguments I make in the project, in the book, that you cannot possibly understand the experiences of Caribbean immigrants to either London or New York City if you don't understand their perceptions of the US and the UK from the Caribbean. What I argue essentially in this book is that the use of culture to explain Black students' success or failure in schools is not only tricky, it's a trap. And it's a trap because we overemphasize the importance of culture, right? And we undermine the importance of national policy contexts, the order of migration, a range of structural and institutional factors that alongside culture can shape what students experience in schools or what their success or failure might be in schools.
And so before we get into some of the differences in history, what's the population size of Black Caribbeans in New York City and in the US?
So to your question, it's really important to pay attention to these figures. The waves of migration from the Caribbean to the US are ongoing. Immigration policies to the UK, however, from the Caribbean are much more restrictive. And so migration from the Caribbean has really slowed to a trickle, the sociologist Phil Kasanitz suggests, whereas, you know, it's ongoing in the US.
This is the end of your listening comprehension test.